I have the honor of introducing our speaker today. He's somebody that I've sat and talked with at length about all sorts of things about life, about AA, politics, and whatnot. I've sat with him in many meetings over the years, and I know him to be a very energetic and person who is alive, who has done a lot of studying and a lot of in-depth searching regarding the 12 steps in his life and the history as well. So for our history meeting, I'd like to introduce Jack.
Thanks, Jim. My name's Jack. I'm an alcoholic. Thanks, everybody. And it's great to have that Vicky Paul way of doing it. And it's good to see everybody here. What I'm going to try to do today is, we know the big book is called our textbook, but it's also a history book. It's a tremendous history book. And once you find that and you start to read it, you'll see history in there. Why is history important? Just as the third step says, well, let's go back. The first step told me I was powerless over alcohol. And I couldn't believe that because alcohol had become my solution to every problem in my life. I really believed that alcohol was my best friend. I was closer to alcohol than I was to my wife, my kids, my parents, my employer. It was my solution. And I thought I was driving my car end over end because of highway conditions or something else. And you had to point out to me that it was alcohol. And when I finally learned that, and you got me in here a little bit, and I spent a little time here, you let me read the third step and see that self-centeredness is the root of my problem. That is the very root of who I am. And the root of who I am and the roots of Alcoholics Anonymous are the same roots. Because Alcoholics Anonymous wasn't started by somebody who had better insights than we have. Alcoholics Anonymous wasn't started by people who were holier than we are. Alcoholics Anonymous was started by people just like us. It was you and me. It was just other names on those people. They just seem to be somebody other than ourselves. And what we do today is exactly what they did. And they did it as a solution to the horrible problem of alcohol. And it goes back, probably a good place to start is the clay tablets of Babylonia, where it talks about alcohol and alcoholism. And every tribe would force themselves to work in the fields, to bring in that struggling harvest, to get it in at the end of the year, if they had a bountiful harvest, they'd ferment a little bit of it and drink it and then go out and raid neighboring tribes and have their little battles and take some slaves and get some fresh women to bring into their gene pool. And the drinking was part of all cultures. Drinking was there. And in the biblical story from the Gilgamesh epic to the story of Noah, in the story of Noah we say, it was the last good man. And his good family. He was the last one. All the other people didn't quite come up to it. And God said to him, build an ark. And it sounds like an alcoholic thing to be building this huge boat in the sunny time, you know. And but he did. He built this huge thing. And he took two of each of these creatures that God loved enough. He was going to destroy man, all of mankind, because God was disappointed. But he was going to save the creatures because he loved the creatures. And that was all the limbed land creatures, because of course if God was going to destroy life by flood, all the undersea creatures were going to be saved anyway. So he must have loved the whales and the porpoises, which I'm sure he did. And Noah sailed, and ultimately when he landed, he got out and planted his grapes and fermented the grapes and proceeded to get shit-faced, the last good man on earth. And then he decided, well, what God would love is for me to kill a few of these animals, and he started killing them off and burning them and making sacrifices because God loved barbecue, and he smoked them up and sent them into heaven. And it appears started right back where we'd always been. I mean, I don't know if anything was accomplished by any of that. But that just shows that history was there. I mean, for ages and ages and ages. And people got sober. People could not always stay drunk because they didn't do it as a group. They did it as individuals. And because individuals are as different as other individuals, some people had to find God at one time in their life, a power greater than themselves, and get sober. We know in this country, the Revolutionary War period, alcohol consumption was really high. I mean, there was nothing to do. You had to worry about raiding parties, you had to worry about Redskins, you had to worry about a lot of things, taxes from the king. So everybody drank, and it kept it fairly comfortable. And alcoholism was called a disease and an illness by one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence. And way back in the 18th century. And by the 19th century, when there was no national newspapers, no telegraph in the 1840s, no television, no telephones, no national railroads, no way to communicate from coast to coast, six guys sitting in a bar in Baltimore, Maryland, decided to do away with the demon rum. And they were in the Washington Inn in Baltimore. They made a vow to quit drinking, and they swore off. And they swore off by finding a higher power. And they started to get others to swear off. And the next thing you know, this little group had taken the name the Washingtonians, and with no way to really spread that message except by word of mouth, it spread and spread and spread and spread. And in the course, by the end of the 1840s, there were 500,000 sober alcoholics across the United States. And maybe a lot of them were just drunks and not alcoholics, who had stopped drinking. My sponsor said to me once, how do you tell the difference between a drunk and an alcoholic? And I said, because anybody can get drunk. And I said, I don't know. And he says, say there are three drunks lying in the road. How do you know which one is the alcoholic? I said, I don't know. He says, you reach over and say, can I give you a hand? Can I pull you up out of there? He said, the one that looks up with the scorn in his eyes and says, nobody asks you for help. Don't help me. Get out of my sight. Don't tell me what to do. I said, that's the alcoholic, you know. But anyway, 500,000 of them got sober. And at that time, during the 1840s, about 1848, in a very fashionable section of New York City, Brooklyn Heights, the Strong family built a four-story brownstone residence at 182 Clinton Street in 1848. A big, beautiful, many-bedroom, very expensive home in Brooklyn Heights, New York. By the 1860s, the Washingtonians had picked up some good political support, they had some good political thoughts, and they decided that slavery was not a good thing, and they took a stand against slavery. They got involved politically. And they took some other stands that were political stands outside of their own thing. And suddenly, they found that their focus was not on alcohol, their focus was on changing the world, and they fell apart. It completely burned up and fell apart, and that wonderful thing that was helping so many people went to pieces. Because they did not have a tradition of change and the strong roots of growth to hold them together. And in less than 20 years, they had pretty well evaporated. A marvelous movement that blew away because it did not have the roots to hold it. And that's what I'm going to talk about today. We're going to talk about the roots of Alcoholics Anonymous. We're going to try to give it some life so that they're not just names, they're people, because it was people just like us. By 1895, a book was written in 1908 by William James, a father of American psychology, called The Varieties of Religious Experience. And we might have noticed in the big book that Ebbie had given a copy of that to Bill Wilson when Bill was in the hospital, in Towns Hospital. In that, he mentioned a man who in 1895, Sam Hadley, had gotten caught by a surrender experience. And this book was about the magic that happens in people's lives. It totally changes them. And they used to refer to it as the conversion experience, when a person is converted to something else. And here was this psychologist, this young psychologist, William James, very young in his profession, a very young man, but a very brilliant man. He wanted to write about that conversion experience, and one story he used of an alcoholic recovering was that story of Sam Hadley in 1895. And Sam Hadley wrote that he found Jesus and he dedicated his life to Jesus. He was at Jerry McCauley's mission. And he found all that while he was in jail, while he was desperate, while he was at the end of his rope. And somehow this higher power elevated him to sobriety. And when he got out of jail, he went back to Jerry McCauley's mission. And he said there were about 35 sober people in there, meeting there. This was in 1895, long before AA was started. In that mission, there were sober people. And these sober folks passed on how they had gotten sober to Sam Hadley. And that change in his life was documented by William James. At the same time as Hadley was getting sober, Bill Wilson was born in 1895, in that last century. And Bill didn't have a drinking problem yet. He didn't know how his life was going to be. He was just a babe in arms. And he didn't know by the time he was 9, Mom and Pop would divorce, Dad would go off to Vancouver, British Columbia, Mom would go off to be an osteopathic surgeon, off to California, and Bill would be left with his grandparents. A well-to-do family, but he's going to be left. There's lots of books about Bill Wilson, and there's no reason for me to say any more about Bill than we have to. And the other thing that happened in my life that was so beneficial that I want to pass on to you, I put my sponsors on a pedestal. I always looked up to them, and it was a lot to me like they were caterpillars who had become the butterflies. They had gone from being a drunken caterpillar to a sober butterfly. And I couldn't be like that because I was still a drunken caterpillar. But looking at them on the pedestal kept me from being separate. It made me feel that I was different than they were, that they had something I didn't have, and that was fair. But once my sponsor showed me his humanity, and I was shocked. I did not want to see his humanity. I did not want him to be just a person. I wanted him to be special, like I had wanted my parents to be special. You know, if you've had kids or have observed kids, there comes a time in their life where they grow up thinking Mom and Dad are perfect. And then they start playing with other kids, and they meet other moms and dads, and they realize they're probably perfect. And then they hit an age, and I won't say what year it is, it used to be around 10 to 12, they start to see that the other kids' parents aren't quite perfect. And then pretty soon they start to see that maybe my parents aren't quite perfect. And you find your kids peeking at you from around the corner, just observing you like that. And you look over at them and they duck away. But they go through a week or two period where they're discovering your imperfections. And then they accept you because they have that love that accepts. And they let you be who you are, and they still love the parents. And when my sponsor showed me his imperfections, it was helping me break out of my perfectionism. Because when I was 12, 13, 14, somewhere in there, when I thought I knew it all, when I had all the information I would need for life, my mind snapped shut like a bear trap, and I was trapped inside, and I didn't know that I didn't know. I was locked into my own loneliness, locked in with a belief of perfectionism. And I expected everything to be perfect. I expected everyone to be perfect. And it just set me up for a tremendous amount of disappointment. So when I went to treatment in December of 71, I went the day, December 11th was Bill Wilson's sobriety date. And I didn't know I was going up there, preparing to go there December 11th. And I got there on 12-12-71. And one of the things I learned from when treatment centers didn't know how to be treatment centers, when they weren't professionals, when they were just people giving out of their hearts, the good priest, Father Carmen Giuliano, the little guy with the bald head, and they were Franciscan friars, ecumenical people. He came walking in one morning. There were 32 of us sitting in there. And I think I was the only guy there who hadn't been to prison or a mental institution. And I still had my wife and my kids and a car and a business. And I felt very different than them. But one of the mornings, Father Carmen walked in, and it was a winter, and there were tough winters in upstate New York. This was at Saranac Lake, New York. Up the other end of these Smokies is the Adirondacks up there. And this was not very far from the Canadian border. And I remember one winter, three mornings in a row, I woke up, and it was the first morning it was 47 below. The second morning was 47 below, and the third morning we got a heat wave. It was only 46 below, but it was cold. And that one morning up there, this loving little friar, this little guy who had given his life to serve God as he could understand him, he came walking in the back door to go up front to address these people like myself. And of course, I still felt perfect at that time. I felt perfect. And the only reason I drank was because of them. And if you had those people in your life, you would have drank too. And I felt like I was a victim, and I didn't know that I was filled with perfectionism. And Father Carmen stepped in, and he started to walk by Richie Truett from Philadelphia, reached over and touched him on the elbow. Says, "You got a hole in your sweater, Father." And Father Carmen pulled that elbow away and gave a scornful look at Richie, then caught himself, and he walked up to the front and stood by the blackboard. He said, "Whatever I was going to talk to you about today, I want to talk about perfectionism." He says, "You know, at 2 o'clock this morning, my alarm went off." He says, "And I got up, and it was chilly." He said, "And I could have just started worrying about how we're going to pay the fuel bill this year, how we're going to get enough food to feed everyone, the friars and you 32 guys. He said, "But I had to direct myself first, thanking my God for letting me have a vocation where I could serve." And he said, "And I knew it was bitter cold out there, and I had to go out and shovel out 18 inches of snow to get the garage doors open so I could get the plow, get the chains on the plow, and back that out and start down that hill, clearing that, knowing I'll slip and slide." And he said, "And I had to get out and do that." He said, "Just so those two nuns from the village of Saranac Lake, down on the bottom, could drive up for the 6 a.m. Mass." He said, "Don't think I didn't think of asking one of you guys to get up at 2 a.m. with me to go out and help do that." He said, "But I didn't." He says, "You know, you're going through what you're going through, and you always complain about that you don't know what I'm going through." And he said, "So I let you go through what you had to go through." And he said, "And as I got up and started to bundle up and got my flannel underwear on," he said, "I put on an old sweater that my mother had knitted for me when I went away to become a priest." And he said, "I had buried my mom." He said, "But every time I put on that sweater, I just feel her love." He says, "I just put that on and I feel her love." And he said, "I put that on and I said, 'God bless you, Mom.' And I got dressed and I went out and I got my scarf around and got my earmuffs." And he said, "And I started shoveling." He says, "And I got feeling some joy that I could be out there doing this for you guys, for those nuns, for everyone." He says, "And I got a joy." He said, "And I could look and see some lights going on up there." He said, "Around 5 a.m. And I said, 'Wow, it must be getting near 5. I hope I'm getting this done.'" And he said, "And I finished it on time to get in and say Mass." He said, "To say my prayers for all of you guys. He's because this is my life today. It's for you guys." And he said, "And I said my prayers for you." He said, "And I was so grateful that I had my mom's sweater." He said, "And I stepped in the door, and the first thing Richie did was touch the hole in the elbow of the sweater, which is inconsequential. It is less than 1/500th of the fabric of the sweater. It let no body heat out." He said, "I didn't feel a cold elbow while I was out there." He said, "That hole means absolutely nothing. And what he did is what you all do constantly. You'll pick out the flaw in another human being and never see the good of that person." And I didn't know what he was talking about. You know, in my perfectionism, he was just ranting and raving about something, you know. So if I talk about the history of Alcoholics Anonymous and say some things that are personal, that are holes in the elbows of the people that we have on pedestals of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's not done in a disrespect. It's to show you that you are no different than Bill Wilson. You're no different than Bob Smith or Jim Burwell or Hank Parkhurst. You're no different from Fitz Mayo or Florence Robeson. You're no different than any of those people. See? And we're blessed. We're the recipients today. The only reason we're here this morning is because Alcoholics Anonymous developed roots. And if it had no roots, it could not be alive today. And the roots are to be treasured, because the roots are what holds it together. So Bill was born in 1895. The country was moving in a good direction. By 1910, the patent office, the director said everything had been invented that could be invented, and they thought of closing the patent office. It was just a wonderful time. You know, the telegraph went across the world. There were wires everywhere. People had telephones. They could crank it and say, hello, hello, can you hear me out there? You know, it was just a fantastic time. The railroad had gone coast to coast. And we'd finished the Spanish-American War and taken a lot of territory. New Mexico, you know, Colorado, we had gotten some places. Florida, we picked up a lot of Spanish territories, and we got a few out in the oceans in the Pacific, and we were geared to grow. And didn't know we were going to go into a world war, and you could pick that up in Bill's story about him going to World War I. But we know in 1895, if Sam Hadley had gone to Jerry McCauley's mission, and there were 35 sober people there, it's fair to assume that that was going on in other cities just as well. Because wherever there's a dedicated person reaching down to feed the hungry, to care for the sick, to show love where there's no love, to bring hope where there's no hope, to bring understanding where there's no understanding, miracles happen. And they've been happening in missions all around the country. But they weren't connected because they were isolated places. See, what AA did was start the network, the connections. But we'll get into that. By 1927, after the war, a very brilliant young minister from New York City, or had gone to New York City, he was in China at the time. His name was Sam Shoemaker. And while he was over there, he met another young minister, seized by a purpose greater than himself, the love of the first century Christians, of doing good for people. And that was Mr. Buckman. And Buckman mentioned some ideas that he had and how to reach people. And Sam, of course, was caught with this idea of carrying the message. And, of course, Buckman had a fair point of view that would be different than a lot of others. And then again, much the same as many televangelists today. Buckman's idea was, sure, carry the message to the poor is good, but if you can carry it to the rich, it will trickle down, you know, it will trickle down and reach everyone. So what they did was reach for somebody rich and famous, and they would reach for that person, figuring if they could help him, they'd get a visibility in the community, and by working with the rich, they'd get some funding to send it on down to the poor. The theological idea was just as good. It was just that mechanical thing of how they were going to do it. So by 1928, Hadley, who had gotten sober, had a boy who was also an alcoholic. And his name was Harrison Hadley. And he went to the Bowery, and he looked over the Bowery, and then he went to Sam Shoemaker. And by then, the Oxford Group had started. And the Oxford Group, Sam Shoemaker of New York, was made the director of the Oxford Group east of the Mississippi. And young Hadley went and saw him as a clergyman and said, you have an old mission down in the Bowery that nobody's using. It's closed. It's not doing any good. Could I use that? Could we open that? And he said, for what purpose? He says, I'll clean it. I'll do things. Maybe we can sober some people up. He says, I'm a recovered alcoholic. My father was. Maybe we could get a mission going like Jerry McCauley's mission down there if you'd let me use it. And they opened in 1928 the Calvary Mission. It was named after the church's house, Calvary House, and it was named after their mission. It was a combination of the two names. And in 1928, they started sobering people up, getting them to surrender and find a higher power. By then, Bill was really deep into his rough times. By 29, the crash came. Prohibition was on. It was a tough time for anyone. It was just a tough time. But in that mission, some people were getting sober. When they finally did write the big book, Bill said in there, it really started when a certain American businessman went to Europe to see the noted Carl Jung. And that businessman he's talking about is Roland Hazard. Roland Hazard was heir to the United Chemical fortune, or Allied Chemical in New York, very rich. And he had lived in Vermont. Vermont is not the smallest state in the country, but it is one of the smallest states in the country, and there are physically more cows than there are people in Vermont. Vermont is an innocuous place that you don't hear much about. It's pretty. It has the Green Mountains, some good ski sites, and it's a fine place, but it's tiny. And you wouldn't expect anything grand to happen there. But Roland Hazard, very rich, summered in Vermont rather than in the city of New York. Also, Dr. Bob had been born in Vermont. And also, Bill Wilson had been born in Vermont. And Ebbie Thatcher, who was from Albany, New York, where I was born, when his dad died, he owned the big iron mill, you know, back before they couldn't see steel coming. But when iron was the big thing, when you could make stoves for everybody, and it was a big thing, and they made a fortune. And Ebbie squandered it. And because his dad used to take all the kids, because people used to have large families, over to Vermont for the summer, his dad, rather than pay all the hotel rooms, he bought a giant house over there to put his family in for the summer. And when Dad died, Ebbie went over there, and he couldn't keep it warm, so he only heated one room. But there was Ebbie in Vermont, Dr. Bob in Vermont, Roland Hazard in Vermont, Bill Wilson in Vermont. And it's as if a breeze had started somewhere way back that had started to move a spirit of some sort. It started to do something as though it was predestined to happen. But Roland Hazard, according to this, went to Carl Jung and thought he got it, you know, did it the way I did, with the brain and not with the heart. And Hazard got drunk again after a year. And Hazard tried it again, and this time he got it. And he joined the Oxford group to keep it, to keep that connection. And Hazard passed it on to a couple other guys, Siebert Graves and Shep Cornell. And they were pretty good families. And Siebert and Shep took their message to Ebbie Thatcher. Ebbie and Bill had been schoolmates for a year when they were 11, 12 years old. But now they brought it to Ebbie, and Ebbie didn't want it. He rejected that message. He wasn't interested. Ebbie was more into drinking and blaming and being a victim. But they came and said, "We found a way to get sober. We've surrendered, and we'd like to give that to you." And I've done about 18, 20 books that I've read trying to get historic facts and so on, and lots of tapes. And there's tapes of Ebbie Thatcher available. And Ebbie says, the judge had told him, one more drink, and you're going to be committed to the mental institution. And Ebbie knew that. And of course, alcoholism is alcoholism, but the judge said, you cannot drink. And Ebbie said one day he had walked down the stairs to the basement. He hadn't had a drink in weeks. And he lived there alone, but he walked down the steps to the cellar, and he looked, and there sat a case of homebrew. All these bottles were corked. And he realized, if that brewing process has not stopped within those bottles could explode. And if a child happened to be walking down the cellar stairs and those bottles exploded, a child could bleed to death, and something had to be done, so he drank the case of home brew. And that makes a lot of sense, you know. It makes a lot of sense, because I go along with that kind of thinking. And then he drove his car down the road and crashed kitty-corner into a lady's house, and split the house open, and she was standing in the kitchen, startled to see the house blow open. And he asked, "Do you have some coffee pot on?" You know. And days later, while he was shooting pigeons in the city limits, the cops came, and they dragged Ebbie back to court to sentence him. And you'll see in Bill's story that Ebbie was going to be sentenced. He was going to be sentenced, and Bill had heard that and expected. They only drank together once. Ebbie says the only time they drank together was in Albany, New York, where they got drunk, chartered an airplane, flew into whatever town they were going into in Vermont, maybe St. Johnsbury, Vermont Pelier. I don't know. It was a new airport. And they landed, and all the city officials were out there to welcome the first plane, and they opened the door. Out came Ebbie and Bill, shit-faced, falling out onto the apron, you know, because they're alcoholic, like we are, like we are. And Ebbie was from a very rich family, and so was Roland Hazard, and Shep and Siebert were pretty well connected. Bill was the one who'd had a pretty prosperous granddad. But he had struck out and lost his money on Wall Street. But in any event, Eddie goes to the judge. And we know a judge that has told someone repeatedly that I'm going to have you locked up for this insanity is not going to take anything except doing it. He's going to lock him up and throw the key away. And it says in Bill's story that two men appeared in the courtroom. Three men appeared in the courtroom. The three men who came to the courtroom were Roland Hazard, who had gotten sober with Carl Jung in 1932. There was Shep Cornell. There was Siebert Graves, who had gotten sober in early 1934, summer of 34. And there was Shep Cornell, who had gotten sober. And this judge listened to Ebbie Thatcher describing all the reasons why he drank, trying to save lives, and how he was doing all this. And he looked out and saw his son, Shep Cornell, sitting out in that courtroom, and Shep Cornell was sober. And he looked over at that man, Roland Hazard, and thought, I don't know how you did this, but I love my boy as much as any father could love a son, and he couldn't get sober for his mom or for me. And you have done a miracle in our lives. And when the court session was over, the judge says, I sentence you to go with that man, Roland Hazard, and do whatever he tells you to do. You follow his instructions, you do what those men did, and I'll give you a chance. And Ebbie did what they said, and he took him that night to speak in a church, to carry his Bible, to get out there, speak in a church. That night, to go out and speak on a street corner with his Bible. He went to a school the next day, and he did street corners with his Bible and said he was sober. And Ebbie could not believe he was sober. Then Roland Hazard said, gentlemen, we're going back to New York City. And Ebbie said he thought Bill Wilson. And he came to New York. And Bill Wilson got a message from Ebbie, heard the message. He said Ebbie made the point-blank declaration that God was doing for him what he could not do for himself. And that's our 12th promise. But there was Ebbie. He said, I got religion. And Ebbie was, he didn't rant or rave. Ebbie was sober. He had the experience and he brought it to Bill. And Ebbie had moved when they got to New York to the Calvary Mission, you know, down with Harrison Hadley, Steve Giraldsek, Siebert Graves, and Spoons Costello, Billy Dee, a bunch of guys who were sober, a whole bunch of guys who were sober down there. And Ebbie moved in there, and Bill went out and got drunk. And Bill drank since that November afternoon when he got the message. He kept drinking. He couldn't get sober. He was like I was, like most of us were. And finally, Bill decided to go down to that mission. Of course, he went and he had a spiritual experience and got up and promised to turn his life over to God and everything. He was so drunk, they tried to bar him from the meeting. And he got up there and they fed him a plate of beans and he passed out. But sooner or later, he got into a taxi, wrote a note to Lois, I'm going back to Towns Hospital. The doctor at Towns Hospital said that was his third visit. The book says, Bill said it was his fourth visit. And Ray O'Keefe, a student of AA history from Miami, he said he saw the Towns Hospital records. It was sold and it isn't Towns anymore. But he saw the records and he said he showed Bill Wilson was admitted at least 14 times. And I don't know which is true, but it wouldn't surprise me if he had tried it 14 times. He was hopeless. And, of course, Bill's stories of all the times he slipped, all the times he slipped, when he knew all about himself and knew he was alcoholic, he went out again and again, a couple of the times. One, he was taking a bus, and it was that Veterans Day or Memorial Day, and he explained to the guy on the bus, oh, I can't drink, I won't drink, I have a disease called alcoholism, I can't even as much as have one drink, I can't, and the bus broke down. They had to wait for another bus to come and take him, and the guy said, you want to go in and have a sandwich? And Bill, sure. And they went in to have a sandwich. The bartender says, would you like a beer? And the guy says, sure. And Bill says, no, I'm an alcoholic, I couldn't possibly have one drink, you know, if I take it, it sets off in me something that I can't handle, and I couldn't possibly drink. Bartender says, it's on me, it's a holiday. Bill says, okay, because he's alcoholic like I am, see. And he did that type of thing several times. And Ebby was down there doing good, and finally Bill got sober, had his spiritual experience, and when Bill got the message, something happened inside him that happened to me when I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I got sober and realized that I did not have to drink, I wanted to stop everyone in the world. I wanted to help everybody stop. And I felt like I was the first guy in history that had gotten sober, right? Because it happened to me. And because, problem we have, we're egomaniacs with inferiority complexes, and we believe the universe revolves around the perpendicular pronoun. And there was Bill caught with the power of God blew right through me. I'm the first guy to get this. And he went to the Calvary mission, and he stayed sober because he had people giving to him what they had gotten. They showed him how to stay sober. They helped him stay sober. They showed him how to find a pathway to God. He had some good input put in, because it was Shoemaker's place, from Reverend Shoemaker. He got a good spiritual program from guys who had been sober a long time. And then Bill gets sent, broke, he gets sent to Akron, Ohio. And only, there has to be a breeze blowing from somewhere, because there's 50,000 different companies that could have sent him, investment firms. They were all over the place in the 30s. And he gets sent by Beers and Company to go to Akron, Ohio. So this Vermonter is going to Akron, where this other Vermonter is setting out there, and he doesn't know that yet. And because Bill has been touched by the Oxford Group, which had started in China, it all sort of moved. And the only reason the Oxford Group, it wasn't in Akron. The Oxford Group wasn't in Akron. It hadn't been in Akron. But because they knew if you can get to the top and take care of the rich first, it will trickle down. Harvey Firestone Jr. had a drinking problem. So let's go sober him up. Became the glorious, wonderful first century Christian movement with money that could help somebody have a conversion experience in their life. And it was so wonderful that people went there. And one woman, Henrietta Seiberling, who had married Seiberling, the president of Goodyear, his son, now she was going through a divorce, and she had made a real contact with Ann Smith, the wife of this drunken doctor. And they used to talk almost daily, because going through a divorce and having a drunken husband gave the two women something to talk about. And they bonded, and Dr. Bob had been going since 1933. He'd been going to the Oxford Group, but he could not stop drinking. And Bill is out there without his support group in New York, without his support group. So he starts, I got to connect with Oxford Group. And he starts his connection with Oxford Group, and on the 10th call, he finds somebody who puts him in touch with Henrietta Seiberling, and that Mother's Day, he meets Dr. Bob. Dr. Bob gets struck sober. Dr. Bob goes to the medical convention. Dr. Bob drank all the scotch on the train. And Dr. Bob acted like an alcoholic. He went out and he got drunk. And while he was away getting drunk, Bill found another doctor that he was working with, and that doctor didn't get sober. Bill tried. And Bob got back. And, of course, he was a proctologist, and only God could have planned this, that Dr. Bob would be a specialist at working with assholes. It's just an amazing, amazing thing. But, again, it's one of the coincidences that form our roots, that here Dr. Bob, this rectal surgeon, he was too shaky to operate, and he had an operation scheduled that day, and Bill gave him a few beers, to steady his nerves, to stop the shakes, which I can identify with. And Dr. Bob proceeded that June 10th, 1935, to have his last drink before his surgery. 10 days later, Eddie R. came. He's a little rich kid from Youngstown, Ohio, very rich and spoiled. He came with his wife and two kids and moved in with Dr. Bob. And age is a very relative thing. It's a very relative thing. If I went and talked to a group of 100-year-olds today, they'd call me Sonny. The 6-year-old thinks the 2-year-old is a baby. The 10-year-old thinks the 8-year-old is a baby. The 16-year-old thinks the 14-year-old is a baby. The 21-year-old thinks the 17-year-old is a baby. It's all relative. When I used to carry the message to the juvenile felons in Broward County, I'm from South Florida, they were middle-class white kids who had killed somebody. They had killed someone. And they didn't know that when they turned 18, they were 15 to 17. When they turned 18, they were going to be sent to a massive prison, state prison, where they were going to become fodder for the meanest men that the state could assemble. To pass those around, to pass those kids around. Let them find out what powerlessness is. And I used to go in with a message trying to reach those kids. And I used to question in my questioning mind whether that's cruel and unusual punishment. But at least they had these kids on the fourth floor separate from the adult population. And I'd go there alternating weeks with my sponsor. And I'd want to reach those kids. And it's so hard. And when it's life and death, it's so difficult to reach a kid. So I used to say to them, what is the difference in our ages? And I'd say the difference between our ages is, can we assume that we're all various ages? Can we assume that the guy who is closer to death is the oldest? And the guy who has more space between his death is the youngest? I said, like, if all of you guys were going to be dead in 10 years and I was going to last 15 years, I'd be the youngest guy in here and you guys would be the oldest. And the one who was going to die next week would be the oldest one here, even if you're 13, 14, 15, 16, because it's so relative. It's totally relative in the age group. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, the ages in the 30s were different than the ages are today. Back then, a guy who was 27, 28, 30 years old still lived with his parents because of the economic times and because of the family bonds. They hadn't been split all over the country. And the guys came into AA, they were all about 40, except Dr. Bob, who was 55. But everybody was about 40. And there were no 30-year-olds. There were no young people in Alcoholics Anonymous. To Dr. Bob, all these other guys were young people. They were all in their 40s. And all Dr. Bob ever wanted was to be a tap dancer and drive flashy old cars, you know, sports cars. And he just wanted to dance a little and be sober, you know. And he was comfortable, but he was older. He was an older guy. The first young guy came in was that Eddie R. from Youngstown. And he moved into Bob's house with his wife and his kids. And he had a second cross to carry. He was a little mentally screwed up as much as any of us and probably more than most of us. And he ultimately chased Dr. Bob's wife Ann around the house with a butcher knife till she was threatening to jump off a bridge. She couldn't take having this drunk, crazy man in her house. And Eddie R. would have been the third guy. Bob only had 10 days sobriety. And if he hadn't had Bill there riding herd, Bob couldn't have made it. But Eddie R. went back out. But he was 30 years old, and he knew you don't trust 30-year-olds. These young people are the bane of sobriety. You know, you don't want the young people here. And, of course, Bill Dotson got sober. He was 40. And he was the first one not to go back out after he got the message. And then I think it was Phil S. got sober, and Phil S. was about 40, and then Ernie G. got sober, and he was 30. And he just took an attraction to Dr. Bob's adopted daughter and ultimately married her, and Bob could not stand these 30-year-olds. He just did not like these young people, and he would prefer that none of these young people got sober because they're so wild, you know. And, of course, Bill's still out there with those guys. And I think there were the three. Sober in Akron was Bob, Bill Dotson, Phil, Ernie Gehrig, and Paul Stanley. So there were the four or five guys sober when Bill left to go back to New York. And when he got to New York, he immediately went to Towns Hospital to find some drunks to work with, because he'd had a success. And he went to the Cavalry Mission to get some drunks to work with, because he'd had a success. And he went, I'm just going to give you a little introduction of something in your big book. This isn't important, but it's just something you can know. The only guy who got to write twice in here, really, before the book was published and after the book was published, was Dr. Silkworth. They had contacted a physician. They contacted a lot of physicians about the big book, and they got a lady doctor in Baltimore who suggested they needed a doctor's opinion to make this book valid, but she wouldn't risk it. Dr. Richards wasn't about to risk putting her name in it. And they got Dr. Silkworth to write the letter, and he wrote it, to whom it may concern, I have specialized in treatment. I personally know scores. And then he talks here He said, was an alcoholic of a type in late 1934. This was December 11th when Bill got sober. In late 1934, he says, I attended a patient, although he had been a competent businessman, a good earning capacity, was an alcoholic of a type I had come to regard as hopeless. In the course of his third treatment, he acquired certain ideas concerning a possible means of recovery. As part of his rehabilitation, he commenced to present his conceptions to other alcoholics, just as the other guys had been doing at the mission, just as the other guys had done in the Washingtonian group, impressing upon them that they must do likewise with still others, just like all those other guys had done when they gave it to Bill. But Bill thought he was the first one to get it, see? This has become the basis of a rapidly growing fellowship of these men and their families. This man and over 100 others appear to have recovered. Then after that, they asked him to write a letter after he'd read the book. And the least quoted phrase in the doctor's opinion is the one that says, the doctor writes, the subject presented in this book seems to be of paramount importance to those afflicted with alcoholic addiction. Because I know I'm afflicted with addiction. Addiction to alcohol. That's what it means. Alcohol addict is alcoholic. But I'm also addicted to just about anything I've ever tried in my life except liver. I tried that once and never went back. But I'm addicted to everything else. Cookies, Dr. Peppers, pies. Don't trust me with your fudge. I can't be trusted with your cake, your pies. There's a lot of things that I find my addiction carries me into. And it's awful easy to transfer my drinking addiction to something else. And I do that. And this Dr. Silkworth wrote this. And in the course of telling who they are, in the second letter he says, many years ago, one of the leading contributors to this book, one of the leading contributors to this book. How many people wrote this book, you know? An awful lot of people wrote this book. An awful lot of people edited this book. You know, Larry Jewell wrote the stories, the newspaper man wrote the stories for Akron when it was time, and Bill and Hank edited the stories for the New York section. Lots of people put themselves into this book. But before that, he's talking here all about it, and he mentions here, if I can find it, because talking from a book slows me down, and he's talking about people, and he said about 1 year prior to this experience, a man was brought in to be treated for chronic alcoholism. He had been partially recovered from a gastric hemorrhage and seems to be a case of pathological mental deterioration. He had lost everything worthwhile in life, was only living, one might say, to drink. He frankly admitted and believed for him there was no hope. Following the elimination of alcohol, there was found to be no permanent brain injury. He accepted the plan outlined in this book. 1 year later, he called to see me. I knew the man by name and partly recognized his features, but there all resemblance ended. From a trembling, despairing, nervous wreck had emerged a man bringing over with self-reliance and contentment. I talked with him for some time. In any event, he hasn't picked up a drink. The next paragraph says, when I need a mental uplift, I often think of another case brought in by a physician, prominent in New York. This patient had made his own diagnosis and deciding a situation hopeless, had hidden in a deserted barn, determined to die. He was rescued by a searching party and in desperate condition brought to me. Following his physical rehabilitation, he had a talk with me in which he frankly stated he thought the treatment a waste of effort, unless I could assure him, which no one ever had, that in the future he would have the willpower to resist his impulse to drink. His alcoholic problem was so complex, etc., etc. However, he did become sold because Bill was a salesman and Hank was a salesman. And when we read the manuscript, they said, we're trying to sell you these ideas. And it said, he became sold and he has not had a drink for a great many years. And who are those three people he's talking about? He's talking about Bill Wilson, Hank Parkhurst, and Fitz Mayo. And why are those three guys so important? Because when Bill came back from Akron, where he had seen this working out there, he was amazed that what Ebby and the boys had been bringing to him was working in Akron. Bill came back to Towns Hospital, and he was always being fed a guy who might try the spiritual method. And he walks in, and he's introduced to Hank Parkhurst, this red-headed bundle of energy, this big guy, this athletic-looking guy, a couple of years older than Bill, and Bill saw the father figure in him. He liked him immensely. And Hank had been the vice president in charge of marketing for Standard Oil of New Jersey. He was a high flyer. He had 6,000 men working for him. And with Standard Oil, you were never terminated. When your job was through with Standard Oil, they moved your desk out into the hallway. And when you came to work, and that looks like my desk out there, you'd get the message, and you'd haul, get somebody to haul that desk off, and you'd be canned. And Hank Parkhurst got canned. But he was the only guy in New York that had a car, that had a business, that had a wife, that had an office, that had a house, that had a secretary, that had things going for him. And he was over in Newark, New Jersey, and of course, he's just like me. What did he do when he's fired by the biggest oil company on the planet? He gets vindictive and says, I'll put them out of business. I'll show them they can't do that to me. And he started Honor Systems. He's going to sell, because he knew how much profit they made selling to the gas stations, he was going to sell them a little bit cheaper, and he had his sources, so he was starting a thing called Honor Systems. And he had a girl working for him. She was a 23, 24-year-old single mom, a German girl. They used to call her Dutch, and she was his secretary. And he liked her. He liked her a lot. You know, times were tough, and she looked real nice, and she was younger than his wife, and she probably understood him a lot better, and he liked her a lot. Her name was Ruth Hock. And when he got sober, he was so amazed that he got this from Bill Wilson. He was just so amazed because now he's got it, and he can't believe that he's got it. And he wanted to do something, and they thought, what can they do? And because he thought big. I mean, Hank thought big time. And he was such a big thinker that he said, we can make a fortune with this. Let's bottle it. You know, we can make a fortune. And this is what everybody needs. Look what's happening. So there were a few guys sober, and a few more got sober in Akron because they were really concerned with sobriety in Akron. Dr. Smith was more concerned with carrying the message to other alcoholics than making money to pay for his mortgage. He really was caught with this working with others. And Bill was caught with the importance, the real importance, of getting some money into New York, you know, so he could get a car, so he could get some things. And Hank fit right in with that. And Hank says, what we got to do, man, is we got to make a flyer. No group has ever made money without a flyer. And he said, what kind of a flyer? He said, write down what you got, man. He said, what? He says, type it out. He said, I'm not a writer. He says, just write what you got. And he said, what's it called? He says, well, you got a solution, haven't you? And he says, yeah. He said, write it down. Call it, There Is a Solution. And Bill wrote it, There Is a Solution. And they had it. They had their brochure for the magic that they thought they could reproduce in other people. And he said, okay, I got it. What do we do with it? He said, well, we're going to print those up. And he said, but now you got to make it personal. You got to have a personal testimonial. And he said, how? He said, write your story. So he wrote Bill's story. And they put that as a little flyer, and Hank started to mail that out to all the rich people, all the big people, waiting for this thing to catch here or there. In the meantime, Bill made an annual trip to Akron. People were staying sober. Most of the early guys had gone out. Eddie R. hadn't made it sober. Phil had gone out after 6 months. Somebody else had gone out. They just kept going out. And Bill now had in New York two guys, Hank Parkhurst and Fitz Mayo. And Fitz, his story's in the big book. It's called Our Southern Friend. And if you want to read a good story, he moved in. It's called Southern Friend, and that's, there it is. And Fitz Mayo was from Washington, and he is finally, the last day of October, here he was in a pile of hay in the barn, just as Dr. Silkworth had said. Now he's in Dr. Silkworth's hospital, and he is wrecked. And he says, I'm in the hospital for alcoholics. This is page 502. I'm an alcoholic. The insane asylum lies ahead. Could I have myself locked up at home? One more foolish idea. I might go out west on a ranch where I couldn't get anything to drink. I might do that. Another foolish idea. I wish I were dead, and I often wish before I'm too yellow to kill myself. Four alcoholics play bridge in a smoke-filled room. Anything to get my mind from myself. The game is over and the other three leave. I start to clean up the debris. One man comes back, closing the door behind him. He looks at me and says, this other man talking to Fitz Mayo is Hank Parkhurst. He says, you think you're hopeless, don't you? He asks. I know it, was the reply. Well, you're not, says the man. There are men on the streets of New York today who are worse than you, and they don't drink anymore. Who? What men is he talking about? Roland Hazard, Shep Costello, Spoons Costello, John Gerald Sick, Hadley, Billy D., all these guys that were sober, Shep Cornell, Sieber Graves, where Bill went to meetings at the Cavalry Mission. That's where Hank had gone. And he realizes all these guys are sober. He's a fanatic, I thought. And then he asked me if I believe in a power greater than myself. Well, I call that power God, Allah, Confucius, prime cause, divine mind, etc., etc. I'll do anything. Your troubles are over, he says. And he says, and he runs back to get the man. And the man said, 9 days ago, I was out there. And Fitz said, then comes the thought is like a voice. Who are you to say there is no God? It rings in my head. I can't get rid of it. You'll read about Fitz again in the big book before we ever get to Dr. Bob's story. Because this is what's happening where Bill Wilson lived. In New York City, two guys had gotten sober. It had never happened at his house at 182 Clinton Street. And he had two sober guys, and he felt like Superman. He was carrying a message, and he was giving what he had to them. They were accepting it, and they were sober. Besides, Hank had a car, an office, everything else. And he gave Bill a job working with him with Honor Systems in Newark, New Jersey. And he'd gotten this idea, let's get a big book started. You know, let's get the brochure started. And Hank did the writings, Hank did the stuff, and then the idea came, let's write a book. And they went down to see if they could get it published. Money was hard to come by. They went down to see if they could get it published. And who went? An amazing thing. I'm going to bog you with details, and I don't mean to do that, but I have dug so deep, and I'd really like to just skim through this because it's going to get too detailed for you. But there were four ladies. I don't know who they were or where they came from. They were sisters. And if you take four important people in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you take Jim Burwell, who moved into Hank's house, and his story in The Vicious Cycle, you take him as one. You take Hank Parkhurst as two. You take the guy who started the first Alcoholics Anonymous group in Cleveland that didn't let the Oxford people come. Only alcoholics and their wives could come to meetings. Clarence Snyder. And you took those three guys. How could they all wind up married, the three sisters? But it happened. It happened. One was 13th step. It's just crazy how God worked this whole thing out. But it all worked out. Thank you, Larry. But without going into detail, they decided they'd do a book. They went to the publisher. The publisher offered an astronomical amount of money to Bill Wilson, who only had two chapters to show the man. And he said, all right, I'll pay you for that. And then Hank says, why do you think he's willing to pay you so much? He says, because they're going to make a million on it. We'll make the million. So they started in 1938, when there were about 40 people sober, they started an idea of writing a book. And they had to fund it. They had to fund it. And this little pamphlet said it was printed in June of 39. That's an error. It was printed in June of 1938. The big book was started March or April of 1938 in Hank's office in Newark. On Hank's typewriter, on Hank's desk, by Hank's secretary, Ruth Hawk, Bill would dictate it, and Ruth would type it. She was a non-alcoholic secretary. And Hank decided, we got to make some money. And on the back it says here, subscription. If you had gotten a subscription form to buy stock in this company, it says the date, on the basis of being a charter subscriber, I hereby subscribe for your number of shares, $25 par. Par value, non-assessable shares of the 100 Men Corporation to be formed. My check is full payment or partial payment. Sign, name, address, everything. And it says checks may be made payable to the Alcoholic Foundation or to Henry G. Parkhurst Incorporated. Please mail to Henry G. Parkhurst Incorporated, 17 William Street, Newark, New Jersey, or William J. Rudell, 108 Harvey Street, Hackettstown, New Jersey. And they're about to get some money. There's no money. It's the 30s. It's the Depression. But they're going to make some bucks. So the first thing he did, he says, before considering the attached proposal, certain information should be known by the reader. Informed doctors and psychiatrists consider true alcoholism just as much as a disease as cancer. Then he goes on and he tells how alcoholism is killing everyone, how they have adopted a book they're going to call Alcoholics Anonymous. You know where that name came from. When they decided to do the book, they thought of probably 25 or 30 titles. The Broken Glass, The Way Out was a leading one. There were lots. There were 25, 30 titles. And they were having a meeting in New York. And the meetings used to be Bill would sit on a stool and people would sit around him and Bill would talk for half the meeting, maybe let someone else talk. But it was Bill telling how it had worked for him. And in Akron, Bob would do the same there. They were personality groups. Bob in Akron, Bill in New York. And while Bill was sitting in New York, he had to reach a way to get the money, and how are they going to do it? They're going to sell stock to the other members. And I swear to you, if you came into the program and you had money, you were sucked right up by Hank and Bill. They made you very special. And I don't know if they had white chips then, but they sure got your checkbook out in a hurry, because they were pulling a few bucks because it was needed. We had to build hospitals all over the place, you know. We had to do something. We had to change this corrupt world. And maybe we had a plan that could help everybody, you know. We could help people with mental illness. We could help people with gambling problems, drug problems. We could help people from broken homes. We could save children. We could do a lot. What we need is money. And money was the goal, and they decided to do it. And it talks about how about 4 years ago William Wilson was, and the idea took hold in his imagination from a friend. Then he went to Ohio. These early seeds are now bearing amazing fruit. The original Akron Three have expanded themselves into more than 70. That was a sales number. They weren't quite 70 in Akron, but it was close. And he goes on and he talks about how wonderful they're doing, the present program, why you should buy in, how much we're going to make. And they name it 100 Men Corporation. And one-third is going to be owned by Hank Parkhurst. He owns this book. He owns this group. He owns one-third of it. Bill Wilson owns a third of it. Dr. Bob wasn't even asked. It was just casually mentioned once. What do you think of the idea of doing a book? I'm not for it, Bill. He says, well, think about it. He had to sell them the idea. And they're going to sell the other third of the stock. And they got the members. They pigeonholed. And coming up with $25 was tough in the Depression. But they got it. And they borrowed money everywhere they could. And now they're here, and they're going to move this amount of books, and they're going to move that amount of books, and they project the sales figures where ultimately they're going to sell a million copies. When they sell a million copies, they had promised them on the 15,000 volumes the first year, after their money back, they're going to get $10 each. 30 with 25,000. 100,000, they're going to get 150. Everybody's going to make money. They bust Duff to get them to make money. They get all the stock out. And Florence Robeson gets sober. Now they don't know what to do. So somebody says, why don't we call it 99 Men and One Woman? And then they decide that book will be scandalous, and we can't do that. And they wish she'd get drunk, because in 1938, Jim Burwell had gotten sober, and he wouldn't believe in God. And they told him, they were Oxford Group people, and they told him, you have to believe in God. And he says, I don't have to believe in God. And they said, you do. So the group, this little unnamed group of sober alcoholics, as Bill called them, the unnamed group of sober alcoholics is what they were called in New York. And in Akron, they were called the Alcoholic Squad from the Oxford Group. But the New York sober alcoholics prayed that Jim Burwell would get drunk, and he did. His story's in the vicious cycle. Then they had to pray that he'd get back, you know, but they did. They had no sponsors then. You had everybody helping everybody. And because there were so many people slipping, if you listen to the tapes of Jim Burwell, there's some great stuff. He said, here comes a new guy in the room. And it says, I'm going to sponsor him. You say, no, it's my turn to sponsor him. And I said, go ahead, but when you get drunk, I get him. See, they were really trying. They sold the stock. They did what they could. Bill can only remember his dad getting drunk, real drunk, that he'd heard of his dad getting really drunk when Roosevelt was elected. They were conservative Vermont Yankees, and they didn't like the liberal-thinking Roosevelt. And Bill now is living in 182 Clinton Street. You know, his girlfriend had died when he was 17. She went away to New York City to visit for a weekend, and she never came back. She died under minor surgery. And Bill's mom and dad had deserted him when he was 9. 17, his girlfriend dies. He's a young guy. At 18, he'd gone to school with Lois. She was 4 years older than him, the daughter of the rich doctor. And he married Lois. And they had moved to that doctor's house at 182 Clinton Street, and the doctor had taken the closest person to that doctor. He sent him to his father's home, the home that his father had built in Brooklyn Heights. He turned to his own butler, the man had been with him forever, the man who knew everything about him, and knew when he had a stain in his shorts, if he ever had one. His closest man. And he said, I want you to move in with my daughter Lois and that drunk, and keep your eye on him. Don't let him hurt my daughter. And Lois had the family china and the candelabras, and every night for dinner she set out the candles and the finest china. And no matter what they ate, that's how they ate. They ate it as though they were still wealthy. And she had wound up working in a dime store for minimum wage. Bill was still trying to do something other than... And he had driven her to that. So anyway, sitting in a meeting and deciding to do this book, they needed a name. They suggested 21, 22 names, and some jerk, a guy mentally ill, was just released for the weekend from the mental institution, happened to be sitting in the back of the room. His name was Joe Worden. David A. says on his historical tapes that his name was Worth. It's hard to tell when they're just initials. It's very hard to dig through, especially when you've got the same names, like there's two Ernie Gehrigs. Ernie Gehrig the first, who got sober in 35, who married Bob's daughter, and Ernie Gehrig the second, who got sober in 1939. But they had the same name, and it's tough to trace this all out. But when they're trying to think of a name, and everybody starts their alcoholic, we've got it, no, listen to this one, listen to that one, and when it quieted down, a guy on leave from the mental institution stood up and said, "Anonymous Alcoholics." They all looked at him, and he sat down. And they went through and did their arguing and their bickering, and he stood up again and he said, "Alcoholics Anonymous." Looked at him like that. But that must have been planted, because by the time they came out with the manuscript, it was called Alcoholics Anonymous. But they still called themselves in there the anonymous group, an unnamed group of drugs. And Akron referred to themselves as the alcoholic squad from the Oxford group. And Florence's stories here, I would have loved to have read you that. Show you Lloyd T's. Lloyd T was from Cleveland. He used to drive down to Akron from Cleveland, 35 miles, to get sober. And then he started driving a carload, and then two cars, then three cars. And they were staying sober. And the book was getting ready to come out. What had happened, the Democratic President Roosevelt had said to the banks, as long as a person pays interest on their mortgage, you cannot foreclose on their home and kick them out on the street. And Bill was just managing to pay the interest on the mortgage, and now he had a roof over his head at 182 Clinton Street from that damn Democratic liberal, you know, and he didn't like that at all. Bill did not like Roosevelt, and that was hard for him to have that charity. And just as a book was published, just as everything started to go, in one tape, Ruth Hock, when they had gone up to see the publisher, just when they were ready to start printing this book, not the final printing, to print the manuscript, Ruth Hock went. Clarence Snyder, who's way out in Cleveland, going to some meetings in Akron, he got sober in January 30th. His wife, Dorothy, I don't know what she was doing there in New York, going up to the publisher, Clarence's wife, and Hank Parkhurst. The four of them went up, and he got the motel to charge it. They had no money. And in the course of that, Ruth Hock says on her tape, "Well, I was sleeping with Dorothy." She said, "We shared the same bed to save money." When Bill came in and climbed in bed with us, and we talked all night long. And he probably didn't do anything. He might have, because he was human, and I don't know. There's been stories that he was a womanizer. And if I'd been the star of Alcoholics Anonymous, I probably would have been. With people looking cow-eyed at me saying, "Thank you, what you've done for me." It was hard for Bill. It was hard for Bill to be there. But in any event, he wound up on that tape being in bed with two of them, and I don't know how he got in bed with Clarence's wife, and the fact they didn't speak from 1942 to 1950, that might have been part of it. But in any event, what happened? Bill got evicted. The book came out. They shipped a case out to Cleveland. And these 17 guys in Cleveland got the book in April. It might have arrived the first week of May of 1939. They got the big books, and they started out. They started rushing, these 17 guys. And they announced, "We're going to have a meeting." You can read about that in Abby Goldrich's story, which is, "He thought he could drink like a gentleman." They had a meeting at Abby's house and barred the Oxford group from attending. And guys from Akron came, where they had gotten sober, at Henrietta Seberling's house, at Clarice Williams' house, from those good Oxford group of Christian people that had let them come, these alcoholics. Akron didn't like the idea of somebody starting a new group, and they came out with axe handles. And they were ready to kill some people for that. But they started it. They started in Cleveland in May of 1939. And at that time, there were less than 100 people in Alcoholics Anonymous in the United States of America. There were about 12 or 14 in New York City. Ebbie Thatcher had gone back out in April of 37, with 2 years and 7 months.
Because something had happened. Bill had named himself number one in Alcoholics Anonymous. The guys who gave him the message got no numbers. He named Dr. Bob number two. And I don't know why he skipped the other guys in Alcoholics Anonymous, but he named Hank Parkhurst number three. Number three. So that the books here, that Hank meant a little bit more than the doctor did, because in the manuscript, the first book was, the first story was The Doctor's Nightmare. And it never identified the doctor by name, but he was first. The second story was The Unbeliever, Hank's story. And very simply, Hank had become everything for Bill. He was in New York. When you're not with the one you love, love the one you're with, you know. And he and Hank had something good going. And his books got out to Cleveland and they started publishing them. And different stories are told, but Clarence Snyder was one of these 30-year-olds, one of these young people. And when he bolded, this 30-year-old, Bob had his fill with 30-year-olds. And this 30-year-old is starting his own group in Cleveland, and it's fried everyone, but Bob came to bring the peace. Bob came, and they started that group. Then they got so many people. What he did, he brought a drunk in who worked for the Cleveland Plain Dealer, a great writer who got sober, got caught with the spirit. Clarence says, write about it. And he wrote about it. And he did front page editorials. And essentially they said, AA is wonderful. And it's yours. It's yours if you want it. And Cleveland started to get big. And Cleveland started to get a lot of people. And they didn't have Bill Wilson or Dr. Bob there to tell them what to do. So they had to pass on. And guys with 1 week were working with another guy. And they invented sponsorship in Cleveland, Ohio. And they invented that sponsorship. And at the same time, Clarence Snyder not only had these guys coming in, he had to get control of it. It was happening too fast. So he took Bill Jones, who worked in the bank, and named him to be the treasurer of Alcoholics Anonymous, because Clarence had taken the name of the big book to be the name of this group, this fellowship, Alcoholics Anonymous in Cleveland. And he named Bill Jones to be the treasurer, and he named the other guy to be the recruiting director. And I don't know the time, and I don't know where we're at. And it's 12:30?
9 minutes.
Well, let's get it in 9 minutes. He named this other guy to be the recruiting director. And here's where the change happened in Alcoholics Anonymous. The change happened that let it grow big enough to be who we are today. Because Bill had thought he owned it. Back when they went to the first Rockefeller dinner, Rockefeller had given them Ivy Lee, which is the biggest public relations firm on the planet. They had to be smart because they were Rockefeller's official PR firm. And he gave them for AA to use, this unnamed group of drunks. And Ivy Lee's newspaper accounts say that Alcoholics Anonymous started when three men got sober. Now, that was three men. Now, Ruth Hawk says that was Bill Wilson, Hank Parkhurst, and Fitz Mayo. Some others think it was Bill Wilson, Hank Parkhurst, and Dr. Bob. And in Bill's writings, he said he was trying to raise money because he thought two or three of us might be able to hold on and make this thing go. And in any event, Clarence got it going big. Clarence got all this stuff happening. Clarence sat on the stool. He was another personality cult there in Cleveland. And it took a genial guy, Al G., whose story's in the big book, he had to nudge Clarence and say, you have so much wisdom that when you sit and chair that meeting every week, you're giving it to us too fast. Some of these new men can't digest all that marvelous stuff you have in your mind. We sort of like to save you. And if we could get other people to take turns, you know, we'll always have you right there to fill us up when we stumble. And for the first time, Alcoholics Anonymous had rotation. A rotation was started by Abby Goldrich, the patent attorney, when he got Clarence off that stool. And what happened was, there was a baseball player. Baseball was the national pastime. Baseball was the biggest thing happening in America. And they found a young person from the fields out in the country who could throw a baseball faster than anyone in history could throw a baseball. His name was Bob Feller. And they were going to bring this kid up to play the major leagues in Cleveland, Ohio. And this kid, Bob Feller, is coming up. And he was a player. And what they needed, if they could get the best catcher, a super catcher who had the experience, who knew how, if he knew how to pitch to everybody in the league, the best hitters, if he was sober, if he could be a roommate with this kid, that kid could learn to be a major leaguer. No matter how dumb he was, he could get the encouragement. And he had a kid named Raleigh Helmsley, who was pushing 40. He played in the All-Star games. He'd been traded from team to team to team because he was a loss. It was always their fault. He was a drunk like me. And Raleigh Helmsley got out there, and he was a drunk. And he moved in with this kid, Bob Feller, and he started to catch him, and Bob Feller threw a no-hitter, and that doesn't happen. And Bob Feller threw another no-hitter, and he pitched like he was a mature pitcher instead of a teenage kid from the country. And Raleigh Helmsley was the toast of everybody. How is this happening? How is this happening? And in 1940, Raleigh Helmsley told the press that I am celebrating 1 year sobriety. I got it from Alcoholics Anonymous, which was founded here in Cleveland, Ohio. We have no national leaders. We just have a blank post office box in New York City, and there's a secretary there, the only paid person we have. And she will take names of people who write into that blind address for help and send it out to us. And we try to reach out and get those people. And that's what we are. There's no leader. There's no one. And when Raleigh Helmsley spoke in Cleveland or whatever city he was playing, it hit the sports pages all over the country. And when it hit the New York papers, Bill Wilson read that, and he was shattered. He was shattered. Not only were the people in Cleveland getting sober without him, not only was that group in Cleveland being done by one of those young farts, you know, it was a 30-year-old upstart. Not only was Cleveland growing leaps and bounds, Helmsley, when he spoke of his sobriety, it hit every paper and everybody wrote to Cleveland. And Alcoholics Anonymous, which had fudged to say we are 100 men and women, and it wasn't 100 men and women, it jumped to 200 with Cleveland. And with Raleigh Helmsley being the recruiting director and saying write to us in Cleveland, it jumped to 2,000. And today, many, many people say Alcoholics Anonymous started in Cleveland, Ohio. And I know that the guy who started it, I'm from South Florida, Fort Lauderdale, the guy who started it in Florida came from Cleveland, Ohio. The guy who started it in Texas came from Cleveland, Ohio. And the guy who started it in Nashville, Tennessee came from Cleveland, Ohio. Cleveland sent out the roots. They sent out the roots. It grew like nobody could believe it could grow. And Bill lost it. Alcoholics Anonymous. A lot of people had said, you don't get paid, you have no reason to answer the phone at central office. Why are you doing that? And when they had Dr. Smith Day, and they got Bill out, and they were going to honor Akron, Dr. Smith, who would help so many people, when they had that meeting in Cleveland, and Bill was invited, casually in conversation, Clarence is talking about all the big books they're moving, how wonderful this thing is, how he was giving of his life. And of course, Clarence was married to Dorothy, who is the sister of Virginia and Caroline. Hank Parkhurst eventually divorced his wife Kathleen and married Caroline, the sister of Clarence Snyder's wife, Dorothy. And Clarence got sober when he was working on a truck and he wound up in New York City, and he had gone to see his sister-in-law, Virginia, who happened to have a doctor visiting when they made house calls, and happened to be Bill Wilson's brother-in-law. And Clarence is saying, I don't know how to stop drinking. He says, my brother-in-law belongs to some cult. He says, there's a doctor out in Akron, Ohio that's sober. He says, there's a few of them. He says, you ought to get to Akron and find that guy. And it is amazing how these four sisters fit in everything that was ever done. Everything that was ever done. I don't know how. That's still the mystery in my computer. Who are these four women? How did they get so attracted to these sober drunks? And they just married all the early guys. You know, I'm sure Bill got a little bit there too. And in any event, because we are not saints, we are not saints. In the early meetings in Akron, the former mayor of Akron, Ohio, came to a meeting. He didn't want to be there, but he came there. And I forget her name. I've got it in my computer notes if I looked them up, and why bother to slow down on notes? She was there too. And they were moved by the Spirit, you know, and couldn't stop. And they were making love on Dr. Bob's examination table when Eddie R. walked in, and that was early before Bill Dotson got sober. And they were appalled, and Bob was appalled, and Ann Smith thought, we don't need that stuff, you know, in our house. These alcoholics, you know, we're trouble. But in any event, The big break came, and we don't know how. And I can show you in the big book where there are two errors, two things that are not true. And the reason they have to be checked, and the reason we have to check our history is while there is still a chance to check our history. I used to be a writer, and I used to cover the space shuttle, and what I found living in Florida was that so many people had come down to build the Space Center, to do different things with it. So many people were involved, and they were all alive. And they're going to be dead. And they were the covered wagon pioneers of the space program. And I wanted to go out and videotape their stories. I talked to some, and I learned. I went out, I got a bunch of people, and I went out, and we chopped through the palmetto and chopped through and took a pole and pounded it till I hit cement out in the middle of this Florida overgrowth and hit cement. And there was the pad where the first V-2 rocket ever launched in the United States of America was launched, but nobody cared anymore. That was ancient history. And I wanted to clear that and put a plaque there. I wanted to do these things, but I never had the financial resources, but I was caught by history, and I wanted to write about it. When I got caught in this AA thing, what I didn't realize was that Roland Helmsley was going to take AA into a big direction. Bill was left with losing his baby, Alcoholics Anonymous. So he ran out to the press and introduced himself as William Griffith Wilson, the founder of Alcoholics Anonymous. Full picture, full name, and he said it started here in New York. And I'm the founder. I'm the guy who started it all. I'm the one. Then he came with Dr. Silkworth and said, he's my co-founder. And then he came with someone else. Eventually he got the idea of Eddie. But I'm the founder. I'm the founder. For 2 years, Bill did that. December of 1940, the man who codified the 12 steps, Hank had gotten drunk in 1939. Bill had decided, we've got to be in New York City. I've got to move the office to New York City. And Hank says, we've always been here in Newark. It has worked. It has worked. When the Liberty Magazine article came out, I'm going there. I've loaned you money. I'm going to take the furniture and hold it as collateral. We've got to be in New York City. And Hank wrote a beautiful memo. I think you'll find it and pass it on. Where Hank said, did Jesus need an office? Was the cause of the early Christians, would it have been better if they had a lot of money? He said, if we get money, would it be better spent carrying the message to others or operating an office? He said, do we need a grand poobah of Alcoholics Anonymous? And among the names that have been considered for the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous was the Bill Wilson movement. So many people were involved that you never hear of Abby Goldrich starting Rotation. You never hear of Al S. starting the Responsibility Pledge. You never hear of Dick Treat suggesting to Bill in 1946, I know you're going through a lot of stuff. Why don't you sort of codify the problems we've had and write some traditions? And in 1946, Bill wrote some traditions. And what he wrote was for the second tradition. He said, let's take the first tradition. He says, each member of Alcoholics Anonymous is but a small part of a great whole. AA must continue to live or most of us will surely die. Hence, our common welfare comes first. But individual welfare follows close afterward. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. And I'll take a long one. Six, problems of money, property, and authority, which we've all had problems with. Problems of money, property, and authority may easily divert us from our primary spiritual aim. We think, therefore, that any considerable property of genuine use to AA should be separately incorporated and managed, just dividing the material from the spiritual. An AA group ought such should never go into business. Secondary aids to AA, such as clubs or hospitals, which require much property or administration, ought to be incorporated and so set apart that if necessary they can be freely discarded by the groups. Hence, such facilities ought not to use the AA name. Their management should be the sole responsibility of those people who financially support them. For clubs, AA managers are usually preferred, but hospitals as well as other places of recuperation ought to be well outside AA and medically supervised. While an AA group may cooperate with anyone, such cooperation ought never go so far as affiliation or endorsement, actual or implied. An AA group can bind itself to no one. Bill moved to New York City where we had to be so he could write rules like this, so he could be the grand poobah of AA. He took Ruth Hawk,
that Hank loved. He took Hank's desk that had been put out by Standard Oil when this vice president of marketing had been fired. He took the typewriter that the big book had been written on. And Hank was left with nothing, and Hank got drunk in 1939. And then you're stuck with the problem. What do you do? The guy who's sober owns a third of the book, and the guy who's drunk owns a third of the book. And even though the book had been Hank's idea, what do you do? And in AA, we don't have much respect for the one who picks up a drink. And yet I do, because it said when they did the second edition of the big book, of those who came to AA and really tried, I don't know who really tries. I only know what a struggle it is for me sometimes to try to submerge the ego. I don't know who really tries, but I assume we all do. It says, of those who come to AA and really try, 50% got sober at once. 25% got sober after several relapses. After I got several relapses, I stopped looking down at the people who had slipped. And it says, and among the remainder, there was significant improvement. I had to go out again and become part of the remainder, but my life has had significant improvement. And I don't look down on somebody who slips. I know it's alcoholism. I know how difficult it is to stay sober when you feel like an outcast, when you feel like a green monkey, when you don't feel you fit in, or they don't understand me. And things happened. In 1946, Earl Treat, whose story is in here, and it doesn't matter which story, if you wanted to read it, he started AA in Chicago. Earl Treat came to Bill and said, write down these things. You might call them roots or tradition. And Bill wrote them down, and it took Earl Treat to come back again and say, shorten them up, Bill. Just condense them a little, you know, condense them a little. And ultimately, Bill did that. But what had happened before that? In December of 1940, Bill, who had been homeless all this time, he'd lived with Hank, he'd lived with others on charity. He lived at Horace Crystal's house and never could call him Horace C. When he did AA Comes of Age, he called him Howard A. Very rich guy, owned a big shipping company, Park Avenue apartment. And Lois and Bill had moved from place to place to place to place to place. And the book had 800 frantic calls come to Newark, where AA started, in Hank's office. Bill yanked it over to New York, to Vesey Street. They moved February of 1940. The book says here, somebody's tampered with the foreword to the second edition. Because my book doesn't read like the newer books read. They've changed it. And it says, 800 frantic calls came into the New York office, which had been established by that time. Not true. Everything I can check, and I'm no expert, you know, but I've done a lot of research. That didn't open until a month after the second Rockefeller dinner, which was February of 1940. And that part of the big book, we miss the fact that our roots were a little office of honor dealers in Newark. We miss our roots. Now, what do you do? How do you get that money back from Hank? Well, what they did, Bill, they had given the royalty to the Alcoholic Foundation, and what Bill decided was, I'll give back my third, get Hank to give back his third. They had to raise $500 and say it was a furniture loan. Give back your third. And Hank gave back his little book that he had started, that he had wanted to see go, that he had worked his ass off on, that he had sold the stock, that he had begged the printer to print it, that had gotten them to give him credit for the hotel room, that had gotten most of the loans they needed, $1,000 from Fitzmaio's struggling sister back in 38. Now Hank didn't own a piece of the book. And Bill says, I don't own it either. They gave that to the Alcoholic Foundation. And Bill Wilson, who wrote, sometimes we hide a bad, selfish motive with a good motive. Bill Wilson convinced the Alcoholic Foundation, which had been Hank's idea. He had written the first letter to Amos, Frank Amos, Rockefeller's man. He wrote the first letter months before Bill says he got the idea from Leonard Strong. That letter was by Hank. About the foundation. And now Hank was drunk, Hank was out, and he had to give back the book. And Bill convinced the Alcoholic Foundation that Dr. Bob struggles. He's gotten a lot of people sober. He struggles. Why don't you give him the 15% royalty? And finally they agreed that poor Dr. Bob, and they gave him the 15% royalty on the big books. And of course Bob said, Bill, why don't you split that with me? You need it as much as I do. And Bill got half that royalty on the big books, and Hank didn't get doodly. Hank was left out because he drank, you know. His number three was taken away and given to somebody else. Ebby was out. Ebby didn't count. Ebby had gotten drunk. See, Ebby brought it to Bill, but Ebby never got a number. None of those guys ever got a number. Number one was Bill Wilson. He got the number. And the guys who got it from him got numbers. And the guys who didn't keep it had their numbers taken away. And by 1940, December, when Father Dowling came from St. Louis, he had to find who wrote this book, Alcoholics Anonymous. Who wrote these 12 steps or the spiritual principles of St. Ignatius? Where is Alcoholics Anonymous? You know where it was. Father Dowling went to Cleveland. They told him there, no, it comes from Akron. And he went to Akron, and they sent him to New York. And Bill and Lois were living on the dole in a two-room apartment above the Vesey Street Clubhouse, the old Soldiers and Sailors Club. And Bill was pretty down. And when he heard a knock on the door, he knew another drunk coming in that I'll have to talk with. And he didn't want it. And it was Father Thomas Dowling, that crippled priest, who came up and just stared golden-eyed at Bill Wilson and says, "You've done a remarkable thing. You've written the spiritual principle of St. Ignatius, just a story of unselfish love. And you've done wonderful things." And Bill let him know, "Yeah, but you know what I get for that? I get people like Horace Crystal, who put me on the dole, and I don't think he really likes me. He let me live in his apartment. He pays the rent on this place. He got a friend to pay the electricity on this place. Do you think I like that? Because I get a friend like Hank Parkhurst who isn't satisfied. I gave him $500 for his share of the big book. I got Ebbie Thatcher who didn't give a damn. He's out there drunk." And Father Dowling says, "You know, you've written these beautiful principles. You should use these. You should put them into your life." And Bill Wilson did his first, fourth, and fifth step with Reverend Thomas Dowling, who became a great friend, a close friend, a spiritual sponsor, in December of 1940. By 42, when they did the Dr. Bob dinner, Clarence just casually said to Bill Wilson, he said, "We're moving a lot of big books." And Bill says, "That's great, that's great." He said, "You always say that's great." He said, "You don't make anything on this, do you?" And Bill says, "Well, yeah, I get a royalty on each one, 15%. 15% of $3? 45 cents on every book? Well, I split it with Dr. Bob." He said, "He gave that to me. I didn't ask for that. I got it for him." And Clarence wanted to start an investigation. By 1942, Bill Wilson, who had been all over the East Coast getting publicity, say it didn't start in Cleveland, it started in New York. By all that time, Cleveland had decided, "You're not welcome at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Don't ever come back to Cleveland. We don't want you." By 1950, Henrietta Seiberling was trying to get alcoholics at the first convention to vote Bill Wilson out of the movement because he was such a detriment to sobriety. And Bill Wilson, who couldn't go to AA meetings because he said, "They won't let me," they started to hold meetings at the central office in New York for Bill. And they wrote that marvelous book, Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, written by one writer who interviewed all the people who knew and loved Bob and felt the love from Bob because they knew that man, because he spoke the language of the heart. And the book Pass It On was written by three separate writers. That's why it's so disjointed, with people guessing about Bill Wilson, because nobody knew Bill Wilson. Nobody really knew him. And the guy who wanted to call it the Bill Wilson movement, if you'll notice when we read how it works, it says, admitted, step one, admitted we were powerless over alcohol. It doesn't say we, because it was written by one man, and it told you what to do. And then that doctor come over from Rockland State Hospital in Jersey and says, "You've done exactly what the Oxford group has done. You've given them those thou shalt nots, and no alcoholic's going to respond to a thou shalt not." He says, "You've got to couch that in simpler terms, like suggestions." And Bill was voted down by the guys, and he had to go in and rewrite this whole manuscript. And he had to rewrite it saying, not "you must," but "maybe you, if you tried this." And that hurt Bill. Now he had fought for 2 years to get it back, and he was barred in Cleveland. He had no friends, and he looked down and he realized Dr. Bob had been pretty steady. He had gotten a lot more people seriously, and he took it more sincere than he did. And all the high flyers in New York had faded and gone. By now, Hank had gone out to Cleveland and drummed up that Bill was a crook. Let's get him out of here. He went to Akron, talked with Bob. He said, "Let's get Bill out of here." So Hank was no good. Ebbie wasn't around, even though Lou Maupin, who from Tennessee, said he had been 12-stepped in 1940 by Ebbie Thatcher in Brooklyn. But in any event, by 1942, the Saturday Evening Post article took off, and Alcoholics Anonymous burst out. And all the places that had sprung out of Cleveland, all those little different groups that had started, all it took was a resentment in a coffee pot to start a new group. And all of that growth by Cleveland was ready to take the people when they did the Saturday Evening Post article. And that AA jumped from 2,000 to 8,000. And it was wrested back a little bit to New York. But people in AA didn't think New York owned this. They didn't think Bill Wilson owned this. They thought it belonged to us. And by 1946, with some good encouragement from people Bill had known for a long time who were staying sober, people said to Bill, why don't you give it to them? And by 1950, he'd got the traditions approved, and he gave it to them. An amazing thing when you look, the power of this book, the power of surrender, comes when you read the traditions. You know how long the traditions are? And if you want to goof up your sponsor, ask him which tradition in the long form is shorter than the same tradition in the short form. And of course, it's a second tradition. The second tradition says, who runs AA? Was it Cleveland? Was it Dr. Silkworth? Was it Henrietta Seiberling? Was it Bill and Bob? Who runs AA? And the second tradition says, in the long form, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as He may express Himself in our group conscience. That's us. That's us. We're a group. God will express Himself to us, not to Bill, passed down to us like it did to the clergymen, the high priests, the grand shamans. Us, who are we? Well, we're just like those guys, but we don't have to organize the whole thing. It ought never be organized. And when Earl Treat got to Bill, and Bill shortened him up and said, what do you think of that? He said, you might add one thing if you're so moved. And they added the last words that were written on the 12 traditions were added to the second tradition. And that's why it's the longest tradition, longer than the long form, because they added after that, a loving God as He may express Himself in our group conscience. And then they added, our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Bill said, let's give it to them. Let's give it to them. He wrote that down and gave it to them. Became anonymous. Got great. I love the great song by Bob Dylan that describes who we are when we've gone through that process of the fifth step. He says, you're invisible now, got no secrets to conceal. And Bill Wilson became invisible and started refusing awards. He started slipping down. He gave it away. And Bill Wilson became like one of us. And he has a hole in his sleeve. You know, he's an imperfect human being. When Dr. Bob died, he left his royalty to Bill. Not to his wife, not to his kids. He left that his share of the royalty to Bill. Bill got the whole 15%. When Bill Wilson died, he left 13% to Lois and 1.5% to his girlfriend. And she was the one who had been with him the longest of his mistresses. She had worked in a central office. And Bill probably needed that. I know if I'd been in his position, I would have needed that. Because you don't understand what I'm going through, you know? See, if I can't become one of us, I have to suffer by myself. And I know today that I am part of us. And nothing I said has been to knock Bill. It's been to humanize him. Because the purpose of spirituality is to humanize us, to make me know that there is no perfection in my life. The perfection is when I let go, when I love instead of wanting, when I love instead of lust. And after the Father Tom Dowling experience, Bill Wilson said, the only thing I'd ever change in the big book. Somebody said, I'd change rarely to never. Not true. Clarence Snyder said that. The guy who, that 30-year-old guy who got AA kicked off in Cleveland. Bill said, I would add the 7 deadly sins to the fourth step. And when the 12 and 12 was written, Bill Wilson got the royalty. It was written by Powers. But they said he was the editor. But Bill was in too much of a depression to write. He got some insights into it. A lot of things weren't quite done by Bill. But what he did, he tied together Akron and he tied together New York. And he tied together these other towns. And one book held those towns together. And guys got sober. The guy who started it in L.A. was handed the big book in Colorado, stayed drunk, wound up in Palm Springs, California, opened his suitcase, read the big book, and was struck sober.
And L.A. had started the meeting. It didn't hold together, and it had faded and fallen apart. And when he got to L.A., like a typical alcoholic, like you, like me, Mort Josephson went in there sober and had never been to a meeting in his life. He had 6 months sobriety. He'd never been to a meeting in his life. He'd read the big book and gotten sober. The magic had occurred that they didn't need Bill or Bob. And he sat down with a couple new guys, and they said, "We've never been to a meeting either. What do we do? You're the one who's sober." And he did what I would do or you would do. He faked it. He said, "Let's read how it works." And we've been doing it ever since, you know, because they were no bigger than we are. They're the same as we are. They learn to love. They learn to get unselfish. They learn to become anonymous. They learn to become one of many instead of trying to stand out. And Harry T. Bode, who helped them so much, said, he's mentioned in the big book twice, he said, "I believe that any time Jesus spoke of Satan, he meant the ego." And I said to my sponsor, "I believe that. I believe that Satan is the ego that lives within me, just like the God lives within me. That what I need is given by God. What I want is directed by Satan." And a lot of people did a lot of things. And I just want to give you a picture of anonymity. You've all heard this. I just want to read this and read the last line and then tell you something. This is called the Desiderata. It says, "Go placidly amid the noise and haste and remember what peace there may be in silence. As far as possible, without surrender, be on good terms with all persons. Speak your truth quietly and clearly. And listen to others, even the dull and ignorant. They too have their story. Avoid loud and aggressive persons. They are vexations to the spirit. If you compare yourself with others, you may become vain and bitter. For always there will be greater and lesser persons than yourself. Enjoy your achievements as well as your plans. Keep interested in your own career, however humble. It is a real possession in the changing fortunes of time. Exercise caution in your business affairs, for the world is full of trickery. But let this not blind you to what virtue there is. Many persons strive for high ideals, and everywhere life is full of heroism. Be yourself, especially do not feign affection. Neither be cynical about love. For in the face of all aridity and disenchantment, it is perennial as the grass. Take kindly the counsel of the years, gracefully surrendering the things of youth. Nurture strength of spirit to shield you in sudden misfortune. But do not distress yourself with imaginings. Many fears are born of fatigue and loneliness. Beyond a wholesome discipline, be gentle with yourself. You are a child of the universe. No less than the trees and the stars, you have a right to be here. And whether or not it is clear to you, no doubt the universe is unfolding as it should. Therefore, be at peace with God, whatever you conceive him to be, and whatever your labors and aspirations, in the noisy confusion of life, keep peace with your own soul. With all its sham, drudgery, and broken dreams, it's still a beautiful world. Be cheerful. Strive to be happy." It says underneath it, "Found in old St. Paul's Church in Baltimore in 1692. And that's not true. We all know this to be one of the greatest anonymous things ever written. But one of the great writers of the 20s and the 30s, one of the great philosophers, one of the great seekers, wrote a beautiful thing that everybody has found that he didn't make a penny on, and he didn't even tie it to him. He left it anonymous and said, "I found that in an old church," and nobody ever found what church or where it came from, because it came from a guy named Max, who just decided not to put his name on it. And it's as beautiful today as if it had his name on it. See, the ego didn't have to be attached. Love never needs ego. Ego's easing God out. I appreciate all of you came in on a Saturday to listen to something as boring as the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. But it is the most marvelous thing that ever happened. And they started that first step without a we. And it says, "Our common welfare." And isn't it amazing that what we didn't want is what we got? That we took the book, the AA Way of Life, and named it as Bill sees it. And we took that movement, which has no leader, and a sign out front says, "Welcome friends of Bill W." We go to clubhouses, and there's the picture of Bill W. We're all sober today by this book called the Bill Wilson Movement. And if he had not pushed to hold it together when the other guys got drunk, how simple it would be to quit because you quit with me and wouldn't help me. How simple it would be to quit if you left me all by myself. You got it started and you get drunk.
All I've got is my damn sobriety, no job, I'm homeless, I've got no place to live. I mean, it was your idea as much as mine. I'll carry it for us, and I hope you get back here. And our common welfare should come first, and that's what this is. And I'm amazed my voice held out. I'm grateful to be here. I thank you all for this. I know I got past Gene's capacity to tape, but I always do that. I'm more interested in saying it than taping it. And I'm more interested in passing it on to another generation that can dig and look it up. And if I ever write this book, it's going to be called We Are Not Saints. I've got so much that I didn't tell you. And I got into that first century Christian religion, and I decided to start searching the first century Christians. And I dug into the Dead Sea Scrolls, and I'm more into that than I'm into this. And I'm off on a different book called Jesus, We Hardly Know You. And I'll probably never write that one. But thanks for letting me be up here. Thanks.
I'd like to thank you, Jack, for carrying the message. And I'd like to thank all those, Steve and Jennifer, that read it first. If everybody could just remember that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. Now let's close with the Lord's Prayer.
Back. Work if you work, you work out on your own.